It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is an instant reaction. West Coast Mets actually win an extra innings edition of Rico Bronya. Welcome in. Mets beat the Arizona Diamondbacks in 10 innings by a score of 3-1. Let's all be honest with ourselves. This was a game. It took a little bit less than 3 hours, so it moved at a pretty good pace. This was a game in which you were dropping F-bombs and cursing out this limp offense 98% of the game. And then stunningly, because of excellent, excellent pitching from Nolan McLain and the bullpen, it only took two swings and one inning, and the New York Met offense was able to do just a tiny bit, just enough to beat the Arizona Diamondbacks and win what is stunningly their fifth victory on this West Coast trip. They are now 5-2, which is fine, which is wonderful, and they are now 8 games under 500. Let's talk about this game. Let's talk about the fact that this offense was putrid for 95% of the game. You know, you're facing Ryan Nelson, and Ryan Nelson is not Cy Young, and yet the Met offense made him look dominant. I mean, think about what he did in this game. Outside of the Mark Vientos home run to lead off the second inning, and Vientos continues to supply power for a team that is powerless, the Mets had so many easy 1-2-3 innings. We've talked before how they will have 10 in a row, 12 in a row, 14 in a row on a routine basis where they don't even put a rally together. That happened again in this game against Ryan Nelson. After Vientos hits the home run, they get a leadoff hit in the third inning. I wanted Luis Torrens to bunt, by the way. I was screaming at the TV. You know, if you're going to play Luis Torrens and you're doing it because of his glove, you're doing it because of his defense, and you're going to have Francisco Alvarez be your designated hitter, and Torrens is going to bat ninth, which means you're looking at Soto and Bichette and whoever the hell do you decide to bat third. In this case, it was Brett Beatty. Lay down a bunt. And when Luis Torrens was swinging right away, that didn't make sense to me. I think you need to use that ninth spot, that Torrens spot, especially if the leadoff man is on, which is what they had in the top of the third inning. I think you got to use it as like the old pitcher spot and give your top of the order and your supposed best hitters a couple of opportunities to drive a run in. But after the Alvarez base hit in the third inning, Ryan Nelson, who came in with an ERA of 6.5, granted it was one start that brought up his ERA, retired 3, 6, 9, 12, 14 in a row. 14 in a row. That cannot happen. And it was broken up by a really good at by Carson Bench, an 8-pitch walk in the seventh inning, which got Ryan Nelson out of the game. But the Mets' LD offense was extra L in this game. And even after they got Ryan Nelson out of the game, Juan Murillo comes in with a runner on first base and two outs, and Marcus Semien swings at the first pitch and pops up the shortstop. The ninth inning, though, I thought the ninth inning, still tied at one, was probably the most pathetic of the bad offense because you have Juan Soto, Bo Bichette, and Brett Beatty. And forget Brett Beatty for a second. The third hole in this lineup has kind of been a revolving door. There is no great answer for who should bat third. I'm just glad that Carlos Mendoza finally made the decision to move MJ Melendez out of the three hole. It doesn't make sense to have a guy batting third who you're going to pinch hit for on a routine basis. So while Brett Beatty may not be the best option and his, you know, 205 batting average, they don't exactly have a lot of great options. But Soto and Bichette are paid an enormous amount of money. They have very good resumes. And I sit back, and I think most Met fans sit back, just waiting. Just, okay, Bo Bichette will get hot. Juan Soto will absolutely get hot. He's already had his hot moments, but unfortunately, Juan is going through a batting slump right now. Ninth inning, tie game. You're facing the immortal Brandon Garcia with a Y. And you put together a 6-pitch, 1-2-3 inning, three of those pitches to Soto and Bo Bichette. Soto swinging at the first pitch and grounding out the first base. Bichette swinging at the second pitch and grounding out the second base. I mean, that was extra L. That was extra limpy. But, and this is the but, the Met pitching in this game was so good. What they did is it kept giving this offense opportunities. Because if you're trailing 3-1 or 4-1, which is reasonable, you know, the Arizona Diamondbacks score about 4.5 runs per game. Giving up 2 or 3, or dare I say 4 runs over 8 innings is not embarrassingly bad. It's almost expected. But the pitching was so good, they continued to give this Met offense opportunities in a game in which they would not be trailing, in a game in which they would be tied. And so finally, in the 10th inning, with the Manfred man on second base, we finally saw this Met offense, I don't want to say explode, though 2 runs feels like an eruption. It feels like an explosion. But we finally saw this offense do something. Mark Vientos pisses a lot of Met fans off, and I totally understand the sentiment, and I get the idea of, hey, once his value's high, trade him. I get it. I'm not even arguing that. But right now, as the Mets are still involved in a season, right, the season is still going on, it is still May, and there is still time, right? They're 8 games under 500. They're double-digit games out of first place. I get all of that. But there is still a clock that allows them time. As long as there is time on that clock, a reasonable amount of time. We're not talking, you know, September, 14 games out with 20 to go. As long as there is time remaining, we all need to be honest that Mark Vientos is needed. They need Mark Vientos. Because when you look up and down this lineup after Soto and Bichette, who, again, you patiently wait to get hot. You patiently say, hey, these guys have a resume. They're making a ton of money. It may be frustrating. It may take a while, but eventually they'll show you who they are. Outside of those two guys, Mark Vientos probably has the highest ceiling. And you see it. You've seen it on this road trip. He gives them a bit of power that they just don't have. So I'm not waxing poetic about Mark Vientos. I'm not even telling you there's no way you could trade him at some point. I'm saying right now, in the middle of May, as the Mets are trying desperately to save their season, they need Mark Vientos. He was their offense in this game. He hits the home run in the second inning, which gave them the temporary 1-0 lead. And very first pitch, he jumps all over Kevin Ginkle and rips the RBI double, which takes the pressure off. Because what you need to do in these extra innings, and the Mets have done such a terrible job of doing it, is you got to get that first run home. And that may not be enough. That's not a guarantee it's going to be enough. But at the bare minimum, that first run, that runner on second that they're handing you, that guy's got to score. And credit to Mark Vientos, because he didn't just move him to third base. He drove him in and put himself in scoring position. And then Carson Bench, who continues to be impressive. He continues to be one of the mini shining stars, especially over the last few weeks. Behind in the count, rips an RBI double, a ground rule double that bounces over the fence. Carson Bench has 11 RBIs. Juan Soto has 10. I do think we are at the point where Carson Bench is performing well enough. We're batting fifth, or dare I say fourth or third. Absolutely should be on the table. We saw Mendoza move him up to the five hole. The way Brett Beatty's hitting and the way Carson Bench is hitting, I think the Mets lineup right now should be Soto, Bichette, Bench, and Vientos. Crazy that I'm saying that, but that's the reality. The negative, and there is a negative, there's a lot of negatives. Even in wins, there's plenty of negatives with this team. They are 8 games under 500. After Bench hits that RBI double and gives this team a 2-run lead, and Marcus Semien lays down this just absolutely gorgeous bunt. And I loved him bunting. Like, even if he didn't get a base hit out of it, laying down a bunt sacrifice to get that third run over to third base with less than 2 outs, even with the bottom of the order coming up, I have no problem with. Because it goes back to what I said earlier. You got a runner on second, nobody out. You got to score them. Well, you have a runner on second, nobody out, even though you've just scored two runs. You want to score him too. Because remember, a two-run lead in this landscape of rules means the tying run is at the plate immediately. So you really don't have that much wiggle room. So I loved Semien laying down the bunt, and then he beats it for a base hit because it was such a beautiful bunt, and he steals second base. But stop right there. You've got second and third, nobody out. And again, we see this offense. It is the bottom of the order. It's Melendez, Alvarez, and Torrens not be able to drive a run home. And that can't happen. And I was fearful when Melendez struck out, and he had a rough day today, 0 for 4. And when Alvarez tapped back to the mound, so he couldn't drive the run in. And then you kind of knew Luis Torrens, as much as he's been clutch before, it looked like he may have suffered a concussion a batter earlier or an inning earlier on that foul ball off the mask. So I had no confidence Torrens was coming through. But to not pick up a run with second and third nobody out was a terrible sign and had me worried that they were going to blow this game. But the positive is they were at least able to score the two runs in the 10th inning. The Mets scored three runs in 10 innings against Ryne Nelson, Juan Murillo, Brandon Garcia, Kevin Ginkel, and Jonathan Loaisiga. That's not good. But what made it good, or at least good enough, was the Met pitching. Nolan McLain really gave you a solid bounce-back effort off of what was his worst start in the major leagues. He had really good command in this game. He made the one mistake to Nolan Arenado. He made the big pitches when he needed to, gave up a two-out double in the first inning, got through it, hit a batter to start the fourth inning, got a double play, worked around a one-out walk in the fifth, worked around a one-out single in the sixth. Just a really sharp effort by Nolan McLain, threw 100 pitches, six innings, one run. In this day and age, you can't really ask for much more. You can't. I mean, I'd like to, but, you know, if we're being realistic, six innings, one run is as much as you're realistically going to get on most days from a starting pitcher. I guess you'll be able to mix in occasionally the eight-inning performance. But great effort by McLain. The one mistake to Nolan Arenado. That was the one negative. Doesn't get run support, so it's another reminder that he's got some DeGromitis in him. Luke Weaver scares the crap out of us because he comes in and you could sense he's got an extra giddy up on his fastball. He's facing his former team, gets the first two guys out, and then loses Gabriel Moreno, walks him, gives up a base hit to Jose Fernandez when he's ahead in the count 0-2, which was always a killer, walks the ninth place hitter. And so Luke Weaver, after getting the first two outs, has this showdown, this bases loaded two out showdown in the seventh inning. Another one of those pivotal moments where the game is on the line, especially with the way the Mets were hitting, and Weaver's able to calmly get the ground ball to first base. Brooks Raley, and I'm managing along with Mendy at this point. So far, I'm totally with him with how he handled this. Weaver in the seventh, Raley in the eighth. Raley gets bailed out by a tremendous defensive play by Marcus Semien. I've said a lot of negative things about Marcus Semien, and I don't take any of that back because offensively, even though he's had his little spurts, the four-hit day a couple days ago, there is a sense that he's probably washed when it comes to his bat. But I commend his defense. His defense has been great all year. I got to be fair. I have to call it like it is. The bat's been bad. The glove's been awesome. He has not lost a thing defensively at second base. I know there was that one difficult play he didn't make a couple of weeks ago. And what I said at the time, and I stand by this, is that when you're not hitting and you're going to be a 220 hitter, well, then your defense better be extraordinary. You better make every play. And I would say so far he's made almost all of them. And he made a great diving play to rob Nolan Arenado because it looked like Brooks Raley was going the way of Luke Weaver after getting the first two outs of an inning, putting himself in a lot of trouble. But Semien made the great play. Now let's get to the first and second guessing of the ninth and 10th inning. I agreed going to Devin Williams, and I'll tell you why. Cause I know there's a school of thought that, all right, it's the bottom of the order. You got the Manfred man rule. Why not try to steal three outs from someone else in your bullpen? Maybe Tobias Myers right there, maybe Austin Warren if he was available, or Waskar Brazoban if he was available. And then you go to Devin Williams in the 10th inning where it's going to be a tougher situation because you trust Devin Williams probably more than any of those other guys I mentioned, even though probably trust Brazoban the most at this point. But the reason I was good with going to Devin Williams is I just have to extend the game. And sometimes I don't always feel that way. Maybe if the team was playing better, I'd have a different level of confidence. But at this point in the 9th inning of a tie game, I can't get cute. I can't get cute where I'm trying to steal outs so I can use Devin Williams with the Manfred man at second. I just can't do it. I need to extend the game. And Devin Williams, who continues to look really, really good, I'd say ever since the implosion and then the odd game against Minnesota where he was supposed to come in, didn't come in, and scared us all half to death, and I wanted him out of the closer's role, and I certainly wasn't alone. He's been great since then, and he was great. In fact, he was so great, and Gary Cohn was all over this. He was so great in the 9th inning that because he only threw 8 pitches, the question was, do you bring Devin Williams out for a second inning? And my thought was, well, yeah, absolutely, especially because I don't know how much availability I have in this bullpen. Like, I know I have Tobias Myers, but how much more do I actually have? So I was looking, and I'll read it to you a little bit. The one thing I kept looking back at was, even though he hasn't thrown a lot of pitches, how often has Devin Williams pitched multiple innings? If you go back to the 2025 regular season with the New York Yankees, Devin Williams never pitched 2 innings. In fact, the most outs he got in any game was 3. If you look at this season, Devin Williams, most outs he's ever gotten this season is 3. So in 2026 and 2025, Devin Williams was never asked to get more than 3 outs. You go back to 2024, same thing. Never asked to get more than 3 outs. You go back to 2023, and we can find a handful of games in which he was asked to get 4 outs, and one game back on May 16th, 2023, where he was asked to get 5 outs. But you're noticing a trend. We have not yet found a game in which Devin Williams pitched 2 innings. Go back to 2022, same thing. There were 2 games in which he got 4 outs, and one game in which he got 5 outs. We are now into 2021. Can I find a 2-inning game from Devin Williams? I can't. In 2021, every game was 1 inning or less. So now we go into the pandemic season of 2020, and we look, and then we find 2-inning games. We don't have any 2-inning saves, but we have a 2-inning win back on September 25th, 2020. A 2-inning game in September of 2020, all in September of 2020. They were really riding him that year. So when you see that and you notice that Devin Williams doesn't pitch multiple innings, has not pitched multiple innings, that's where you pause. That's where you say, all right, even though in the moment it felt like a no-brainer, in the moment it's like, it's only 8 pitches. It's not a big deal. We hear so much about the ups. Would it have been a big deal? Doesn't seem like one, but I guess it would have. So if you look at Devin Williams' track record, this is not something he's done. So Mendy goes to Tobias Myers with the 2-run lead and a great bounce back effort by Tobias Myers. I actually had a little bit of a level of confidence in him because despite how bad he was a few days ago, and we just gave him the net negative from that 3-game series against Colorado because of how he impacted the bullpen the next day, he's mostly been good. So I looked at that game against the Rockies, as bad as it was, and the hardware he picked up as the net negative, as an outlier. And I think Tobias Myers proved that. He made this very easy, made this very stressful. A strikeout of Barroza and then 2 very quick outs against Perdomo and Vargas. He secures his first major league save. He shuts in the door, or shuts the door, whatever the stupid phrase is. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, man, as I'm doing this, Rico. So Myers does a great job, and the Mets get a victory that they needed behind really good pitching. And I've said this before, and I think today is another example of it. If the Mets are going to win games, and they've been winning games recently, I mean, the record is the record. They are 5-2 on this road trip. They have guaranteed themselves a winning road trip. Obviously, we want more than 5-4. It would be a massive disappointment now to lose the next two games and go back to being 10 games under 500. But when they win games, and if they're going to win more games, the identity is pitching. That's who they are. That's their strength, or at least that needs to be their strength. And give the defense credit, because I think the defense has played very, very well. There's been a lot of mocking over run prevention. And while that's certainly not an excuse for the LD offense that we mostly see, or the roster construction, which still feels terrible, we have to acknowledge the defense on this team has mostly been really good. That part's true. But they are going to have to continue to pitch at a very high level to continue to win games. Let's read your emails. Let's go through the email mailbag, how people felt as this game was going on. I always find that fun. Let's start it off with Scott, who writes, I may be in the minority here, but I've never loved moving a guy up in the lineup when he gets hot. It happened with Alvarez earlier in the year and in past seasons. I've noticed that over the years, and more often than not, it seems to cool off a player. Any thoughts? P.S. I still don't trust Vientos. We need him, but I'm not going to trust him. Yeah, I don't trust him either, but yes, the Mets need him. The issue, Scott, with not moving guys up in the batting order is that who do you want to have hit third, fourth, and fifth? Like, ask yourself that question. If you don't want to reward guys who are hitting, and I think right now that mostly involves Carson Benj and I guess Mark Vientos, who would be batting third, fourth, fifth, and sixth? Like, there's no ideal order. So I think the only option you have is to not overthink how it's going to cool a guy off, but just play your better hitters. And most of the time, your better hitters, especially in a lineup like this, are just the ones that are hot. Jeff writes, fourth inning, has anyone noticed that when Mets pitchers get to two strikes, they tend to hit more batters than with zero or one strike? Or is that just me? Doesn't matter who's on the mound, McClain, Manaea, Peterson, etc. Well, Nolan McClain did hit Corbin Carroll with a 2-2 pitch. So it does happen. I don't know if it's more often with two strikes, but it happens. James writes, James here, first time. Excuse me. Let me get that cough out. James here, first time, long time. Love what you do. Blah, 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 blah. I like that. Maybe I'm biased, but when I see the pure stuff Nolan has, I don't know if I've ever seen anything like it. I know you've been hesitant to crown him as a true ace. He's only been a full-time pitcher since 2025, and I will die on the hill that he has the nastiest stuff in Major League Baseball. Maybe even the nastiest stuff I've ever seen with my own eyes. This season will very likely be a disappointment for me and every Mets fan, but watching Nolan will be a pleasure for as long as he pitches for this team. Love what you do covering the team. Just get to 500 by August, LFGM. His stuff is incredible. Yeah, his sweeper moves in a very inhuman way. That's, I think, a fair description of Nolan McClain. This season may turn into a lost season. I'm not ready to say we're here yet. I think it will probably become one, but 8 games under 500, May, there is still time to get that slow roll towards 500. But if this season does become a lost season, if this truly is a sell-off kind of year, there at least are a few players that we will enjoy watching for those that hang in there throughout a long lost season. And I'm not just talking about the young guys that may come up. You know, Jonah Tong will probably get here. Jack Weininger will certainly get here. In terms of the rotation, A.J. Ewing will knock on the door, Ryan Clifford. So there'll be young players to watch. But in terms of the guys that are here, you're right. Watching Nolan McClain every 5 days it's fun. Tommy writes, can somebody throw something? Can Brody Van Wagenen throw a chair? Can Jorge Lopez throw a glove? Can somebody show any resemblance of a pulse? At this point, I take Jeff McNeil throwing his helmet. I know you've said it's misleading when they do this, but it so looks like they don't even care. Have they no pride, no pulse, no soul? Every game feels like a slow death. Yeah, when you don't hit, that's what it looks like. When your offense is putrid, and it is, even in a game that they win like this, that's just the way it looks. Adam from Bethpage writes, this is at about 12:20 in the morning, so I'm assuming, I'm trying to figure out where we are in this game at this point. I think they're about to win. Adam writes, longtime listener of the Rico, it's unreal how bad the Mets are in run-scoring productive outs. Whenever they have a runner on third with less than two outs, the opposing team is thinking, we have them right where we want them. This has been going on for years. Yes, that's probably right in that 10th inning with second and third, nobody out, and they can't score. Tommy writes, how about my man Devin Williams made this look easy? 8 pitches, and he's starting to get his swagger back. This is a very good showing for him tonight. 5 in a row that he's been flawless. The story of Devin Williams with the Mets will be a damn good one. Hey, major credit to Devin Williams. He has pitched really, really well. No doubt about it. They needed him in this game, and he was able to do it at a very high level. So great job by Devin Williams. Let me address that one report. I think it came out of Chicago about the Mets and potentially trading Freddie Peralta. I don't know if June 1st is the date. I think it was Bruce Levine who then backed off that the Cubs have talked to the Mets about Freddie Peralta. Just that the Mets will have to make a decision by June 1st on if they're going to sell or not. They don't have to make a decision by June 1st. That's not the date. I think the date is probably the All-Star break, the first or second week of July. I think in this modern age with the 3 wild card spots, you have a lot of time to fix your season. And that's certainly a positive for this Met team. You know, if this was 20 years ago or even longer than that with the 2 divisions or just 1 wild card, you would look at the standings and you'd look at the math and say, yeah, this is really going to be tough. But when you've got 3 wild cards, and I don't know what the record would have to be the 3rd wild card. Like the American League right now, it feels like that number may be under 500. But there's a long way to go. So there's no way to truly know. Like right now, the 3rd wild card team is 20-16, which means if you do the math, the Mets are 6 games out, which is recoverable. So I think June 1st is crazy to say that, oh yeah, if they're out of it by June 1st, they're not selling guys off in June. That doesn't happen. That's a very rare thing to have happen. I think it's more like July. And as we've stated, and I went through it on the last Rico, if you continue to win series, it's a slow climb. But luckily, because of 3 wild cards, it doesn't have to be an immediate climb. I think the reasonable goal is to get to 500 by the All-Star break. And that's not even that aggressive of a goal. They're 8 games under 500. If they win every series moving forward, they would get to 500 by the second week of June. But I think that is the goal that you have. Get to 500 by the All-Star break and then have one big run in the second half of the year. Hopefully this team's capable of that. Doesn't feel like it right now. And that could make your playoff team. So will there come a point where we're talking about trading Freddie Peralta or trading Clay Holmes? Yeah, if they're 8 games under 500 in the middle of July, that will absolutely be a discussion. But it is way too premature. I think back to 2024, there was a lot of sell discussions in 2024 when this team was struggling right around this time, early May, mid-May. A part of it was the core. Got to break up the core. This is different because this is a new core. And you look around and say, how appealing are a lot of these pieces going to be? But luckily, deep breath, everybody, we are a ways away from legitimately having that conversation. Right now, the conversation is, can the Mets go win another series? And with 2 games left on this trip, I'm going to get conservative. I did this with the Colorado series, and then I got pissed off with the way they lost. But split the next 2 games. That'll get you back to Citi Field with a 6-3 road trip. You would have gone from 11 under 500 to 8 under 500, so still a lot of work to do. And then you've got the Tigers and the Yankees on a 6-game homestand, and then your division rivals, the Nationals and the Marlins, on a 7-game road trip. And if you want to look at the season in chunks, I would look at those 13 games and say, can you go 8-5? If you do that, now you're 5 games under .500. But I think what you need to see right now is some consistency. Luckily, they won this game. I am thrilled that they won this game, one against Arizona. But scoring 3 runs a night makes it very tough. Very, very, very tough. And you're waiting for this offense to wake up. But right now, averaging 3.5 runs per game and scoring 3 runs in this game, you start to think, well, maybe this is just who they are. We'll have another Rico Bronya when this series concludes on Sunday. It's a late afternoon game. So figure our live on YouTube Rico Bronya will be at some point about 9 o'clock at night. That's my guesstimation. But if you download the Rico Bronya, whether it's on the Odyssey app or the Apple podcast or wherever the hell you get your podcast, it'll be sitting there and waiting. Appreciate Pete Hoffman. He's doing an overnight show on WFAN and was still somehow able to set the Rico Bronya up. So we appreciate it. Good victory for the Mets. Wasn't easy, but they got it done. And yes, because I'm going to try to be classy, congratulations to the New York Knicks, who are now up 3-0 on the Philadelphia 76ers. And since I did that for you, since I gave you a congratulations, say a prayer to the basketball gods. So it's Sunday at 3 o'clock. The Brooklyn Nets don't get screwed in the NBA lottery. Thank you very much for listening to an instant reaction edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.